Welcome to Imagination Redeemed. I'm your host, Brian Brown, and I am joined today by our Believe to See regular, Jane Sharl. And we have a special guest with us, Corey Latta, and we're going to be talking about time. So I've been talking to a lot of people about time and the theology of time in recent weeks, as Anselm has been going through a stretch as we've been thinking about this as an organization. And I find that the minute I start using phrases like theology of time, 3 out of 4 people, their eyes start to glaze over. And the reason that we think that time is important, though, is because, at risk of stating the obvious, we're all stuck in it. And a lot of the existential questions that we have for ourselves, do I matter? Is my life meaningful? Am I going to be remembered? A lot of these questions have to do with time, whether it's dealing with our past or whether it is hoping, dreaming, fearing about our future, or whether it is the nitty-gritty questions of how we cope with the present. So we thought it would be good to bring somebody on the show who's thought about this more than a few weeks. And that's Corey. Corey, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Brian. It's really good to be with you.
So we're having you on the show for the benefit of our listeners because you've spoken for us a number of times, but we haven't actually gotten to talk to you about actually your academic wheelhouse. You've actually written a book called When the Eternal Can Be Met, The Bergsonian Theology of Time in the Works of C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot, and W.H. Auden. I have questions about whether you picked those three just because they all used letters for their first names, but
you caught on. That was it.
That's the real reason that you picked them, isn't it? That's the real reason. But yeah, in all seriousness, I mean, let's just start with sort of the elephant in the room. Why time? What prompted you to zero in on it? Why is it that we should be having a conversation about time? You know, we talk about lots of things that we just sort of experience day to day, minute to minute, and we take them for granted. And it's not necessarily a sin that we don't analyze all of them. Why should we be analyzing time?
Yeah. So kind of a twofold answer. Practically, I came to the topic. I was in my doctoral program doing a PhD in 20th century literature. I was focusing on Christian literature in the Anglophone tradition. So, you know, Christian writers who are writing in English, you know, being a big fan of Lewis and reading Screwtape Letters and The Great Divorce and a lot of his personal correspondence, I came across this repeated emphasis on time. It's a part of Mere Christianity, comes up a few times. And, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of things that a Christian writer systematically may touch on. And you typically think about like the Trinity or soteriology or the Holy Spirit but time just, I never really thought of time as being one of those principal, you know, theological topics. So why was Lewis so interested in it? Well, I had done a class in 20th century poetry. T.S. Eliot, of course, was read in that class. And if you know the Four Quartets, which I'm sure we'll talk about in more depth, that entire opus is really about time. I thought, well, that's interesting. You have two converts of Christianity, and, you know, I think what Eliot was in 27 and, you know, Lewis was in 30-31, converted to Christianity, and they both turned to time. And then I was a big fan, still am a big fan of W.H. Auden. I found a lot of Christians today don't know much about Auden, but a really prolific, if there were no Eliot, Auden would be spoken of as Eliot. I think he was that big and was sort of overshadowed by Eliot, but he converted Christianity around or sort of rediscovered his faith around 1940. And he too talked about time. Now, if that's what's interesting, why are they all three interested in time? And I thought, just for the sake of a cohesive project, let me just sort of investigate to see if there's any tie that binds, right? Any conceptual or ideological tie that binds. It was reading Lewis's, you know, sort of spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy, that I came across the name Henry Bergson. Never heard of him. Had no clue who he was. And then we'll talk more about him. But I was bouncing around in articles about Bergson and saw one titled T.S. Eliot and Bergson and a Conception of Time. I thought, interesting. And the deeper I dug, the more I found Bergson unearthed again and again and again. So there formed this kind of network, this ideologically influenced network of thought all around time. Bergson's primary contribution to philosophy was about time. That's the initial, you know, academic process, right, that got me there. As I got into the second sort of like why time, we think about time, we live in it, obviously, but we think about time all the time. I mean, in one sense, it is, I'm resistant to say it's the canvas on which our lives are sort of painted, or it's the space in which we live and move and have our being. After reading Bergson, it's more the air we breathe. It sort of goes through us rather than we live out our lives in it, I think. But getting into, you know, these authors, it gave me a very robust reason for thinking more deeply about the thing I thought about practical anyway.
Okay, so get us into that backstory. Before we talk about Bergson, talk about what's going on in their world. All these three sort of intellectual heavyweights, they're all interested in art and literature and poetry. They're all interested in theology. They all, for their own reasons, with some overlaps in the reasons, convert to Christianity within 15 years of each other. And they all turn to time. What do they see going on in their world? What's going on, and how are other writers dealing with time? How are their contemporaries writing about time? What makes them stand out?
There was, going into the 20th century, especially the first, you know, few decades of the 20th century, a real assumption that just empirical knowledge, categorical, quantifiable, measurable, empirical knowledge was the ultimate source of truth. So these authors are reacting against a mechanical age, a spiritless age. One of the ways that I think they come to re-engage or reanimate their world and re-engage the spiritual is to counter the thinking, the mechanical thinking, the positivist thinking of an Einstein by looking at all aspects of their experience. There's no experience more universal or more salient or more important than time. So they all turn to time, but they turn to time, I contend, only in the shadow or the wake of Bergson. If it weren't for Bergson, I don't know. Certainly they would have written about time, but I don't know that we would be here reading the same text. I don't think there would be a letter 15 of the Screwtape Letters or Four Quartets.
So how do you, and just for a little bit of clarification for listeners, there were two philosophers. There's Bergson, and then there's this other philosopher named F.H. Bradley, who was a significant influence on Eliot, and Eliot did his graduate work on Bradley. That's right, yeah. They both were sort of, this is just me, so correct me if I'm wrong. I would describe Bradley and Bergson as working a bit in parallel, but with Bergson inclining more towards like a subjective idealism, where the ideal is real, but it's to be found by passing through the experience of the individual. And then Bradley was really kind of insofar as you could be at the end of the 19th century, he was kind of a classical Platonist in that he believed in absolute ideals of knowledge, which it was challenging to do. And so yeah. I'm just curious about, I see much more Bradley influence in particularly the Ash Wednesday, Four Quartets, Eliot phase, and less Bergsonian because I think obviously there is an element of Bergsonianism. I just wondered if you could talk us through, without getting too buried in the weeds of literary theory, just walk us through, because there are people with significant criticisms of Bergson and of Bergson's influence on Maritain and how that worked through politics and made politics about individual rights and those kinds of things. So I'm interested in how you can talk about how Bergson squares up with Christianity, and it's almost a new vision of how Christianity can relate to individual experience. I don't know if that question makes sense, but that's what was going through my mind while you were talking.
So Bergson was a French philosopher who... It's interesting. I didn't know anything about him either until I started. Like I said, I came to him through Lewis, but he was born in Paris in 1859. He was very prolific in incredibly bright youth. He was going to sort of choose between being a mathematician or a philosopher. He was a part of this kind of spiritualist philosophical movement in France and really came to oppose the kind of positivism we were just sort of alluding to. His first big publication, Time and Free Will, I think was 1889, maybe. He ended up writing around five really influential books. The big one was Creative Evolution in 1907. By the time he wrote Creative Evolution, he was a rock star. One thing I would point out between like an F.H. Bradley or Bergson is popularly, Bradley couldn't hold a candle. I mean, like people.
No, that's certainly true.
2,000 people fit, like in New York came to see Bergson. Think about this. It would have to be like a Malcolm Guite or something like that. I don't mm-hmm. know who it would be, you know, but just maybe a William Lane Craig or something, but a philosopher going to give a lecture and 2,000 people showing up. There were people who would go to his barber to try to get pieces of his hair. I mean, there was
amazing.
A cult of Bergson that arose. We would go on pilgrimages to Bergson's home in, I think it was Switzerland.
Why? What's he writing that's connecting so much with not only academics, but the popular mind?
Well, it is, to Jane's point, there is a subjective quality to it that I think is really appealing. So for him, the big contention, and so what? There's a great book called The Philosopher and the Physicist about this infamous debate. So Einstein rises, you know, he sort of emerges on the scene. If there was one intellectual contemporary who rivaled and for a short time overshadowed Einstein, it was Bergson. And these two were sort of chirping at each other in publication from 1911 to around 1922. April 6th, I think, 1922, they had a debate. And Bergson just absolutely hated what Einstein had done with time. He thought it was the most inhuman, mechanical, you know, a sort of anti-spirit interpretation of this force, this durative force that we all experience that animates all of life, this elan vital, this life impulse that Bergson championed. So I think the appeal was, I really do think there was a kind of epistemic and theological, philosophical malaise that was over the West because of this overemphasis on empiricism and positivism. And I think Bergson was a breath of fresh air.
So everybody's just absorbing this idea that just everything is meaningless, everything is meaningless, everything is meaningless. And then Bergson.
Yeah. I mean, Bergson, if you just pull up his, like he says things like to exist is to change is to mature, and to mature is to go on creating oneself endlessly.
I think that's a huge element about him. He wrote aphoristically.
Yeah.
And you can read him and you come away with those tidbits like that. And a lot of the other spiritualist thinkers of the time, it was a lot denser. So this is fascinating to me because I wasn't even aware of Bergson's influence on Lewis. I know him through Mariton, through Charles Péguy. I don't know him through these Anglophone writers so much. So this is very, very interesting. And I'm wondering if that's part of it, is that he's just a very gifted writer and he is so kind of packageable like that. Because it's such a lovely quote and you can remember that. And it really does affect your life.
He's a poet. I mean, he writes like a poet. I mean, he really does write. So he writes, you know, he drops these quotes that you want to print out, put on your walls. You know what I mean? But he's also,
he's a Twitter poet.
Yeah. But at the same time, he's not cliche. There's enough robust thinking behind these quotes. You know, it's like pulling a quote out of Lewis. Like you could pull out a Lewis quote or even a Eliot quote and think, oh, that's beautiful. But you know, there's such a force right behind that quote that he goes both shallow and deep. That's what Bergson does. And by the way, I challenge someone to name a 20th century anyway. Like the game changes if we're talking about Plato or Socrates or Aristotle, but like a 20th century philosopher or just a you know, in the modern era, philosopher who had more influence on literature than Bergson. Like Willa Cather, big fan. Faulkner, huge, huge Bergson fan. You can't read Virginia Woolf. Mrs. Dalloway, then this is the scene where Big Ben is sort of like clink, clink, clink. And as Big Ben is sort of ticking, one of the characters is having an internal psychological memory kind of experience. Mm-hmm. And there's this Bergsonian contrast between calculable time, right? Quantitative time and qualitative time. In Search of Lost Time by Proust, there'd be no In Search of Lost Time if it weren't for Bergson.
So, yeah, I'm thinking too, it sounds like from what you're saying, Iris Murdoch seems like she's just sort of living in trying to sort out how Bergson makes sense if in light of the modernist relationships that her characters are trapped in. This is very interesting.
Yeah. And so think about Lewis, Eliot, and Auden. So they're all technically modernist in terms of the time in which they wrote, right? But Lewis was a rabid anti-modernist. I mean, this is the guy, you know, in his De Descripte Temporum said, I'm a dinosaur, right? I don't belong in this age. Eliot starts to, because part of what makes a modernist author is this sort of existential nothingness, that kind of, you know what I mean? Like a James Joyce's Ulysses sort of, but Eliot breaks away from that. It's not the wasteland anymore, right? Now it's the Journey of the Magi. Now it's four quartets. Auden, same thing. You could read some of Auden's early stuff in which he is detached from the faith, and it's bleakly modernist. But then you get to Kairos and Logos, or For the Time Being, and it's latent with transcendence, right? So all three of these modernist poets are really become anti-modernist writers thematically. And Bergson was not a man of his time either in that way, right? He was anti-modernist in terms of opposing this kind of positive, you know, scientific epistemology. And so that's the appeal, I think, is he spoke. So Lewis in Surprised by Joy, you see this beginning with Phantastes when Lewis is 16, this chipping away of Lewis's adolescent atheism, right? And he's got some years yet where he's going to have to write himself out of his atheism. And then he's going to meet Tolkien and all this stuff's going to happen. But he slowly has to open up, right? We know the journey is from atheist to theist and then to believer for Lewis. I would say that journey kind of starts with George MacDonald, but it kind of starts with Bergson, in that Bergson showed him the beauties of spiritualism, like that you don't have to be a closed minded thinker. You don't have to be a naturalist or materialist, or that there's actually philosophical heft and appeal to a kind of spiritualist approach to life. Yes. And I think that's the general appeal that he had on everyone, is you don't have to live in that bubble.
So, okay. Is Bergson then influencing all three of these guys prior to conversion, and it's part of the power of the influence, is that he's doing that for all three of them? Or is there some claim that he's making, or some way of looking at the world that they carry with them into their faith that adds something to their theological perspective?
I think so. They'd all, you know, he was so popular and so widely read that they all had read him and known about him. Eliot and Lewis more so than Auden, but Auden's writing a little bit. Some of his work is coming a little later. We have to remember Auden lived all the way till 1973, I think.
I think he died the year before David Jones.
That's not that long ago, right? I mean, so he was actually writing into the postmodern age, and I guess so was Lewis and Eliot too in early postmodernism. But so, you know, Bergson's ideas have been disseminated pretty widely. So why time? So I think that the through line is time. I don't think Lewis and Eliot and Auden and others, I don't think they found. Bergson does a lot with memory that's interesting. He does a lot with sort of, he calls it heterogeneity and like the differentiation of moments and experiences that I think is interesting in novelists. But the through line that I found is that idea of time that becomes, because of Einstein, becomes a kind of fault line in modernist thinking that, you know, Einstein certainly wasn't trying to do this, but, you know, because of this larger context with Freud and Darwin and mechanization, and I think Einstein kind of creates this sort of fault line, like dividing spiritual thinkers from non-spiritual thinkers when it comes to these metaphysical concepts. And time, this is Bergson's entire contention, time is a metaphysical issue, not a physical issue. So here's what I think Lewis and Auden and Eliot are trying to do. Now, let's imagine you are, as a Christian writer, I sort of get the struggle on obviously a far lesser degree. You are writing in the modern age. You are writing essentially, I mean, Lewis certainly gained popularity with like Mere Christianity talks and things like that. And Eliot had his fan base and Auden was very popular. But when they convert to Christianity and you're trying to appeal to a modern audience, or you're trying to write for a modern audience, and you're trying to disseminate or pass on or promulgate these theological concepts, it doesn't do. I mean, think about Lewis's commentary on fantasy fiction. We have to steal past watchful dragons, right? It doesn't do to simply say, well, here's the Christian idea of time. God is outside of it. Every moment's present for him all the time. He does that a little bit in Mere Christianity. But if you're trying to creatively convey a theme like that, I almost see the way I envision it was here's the general audience. Here's the theology that Lewis and Eliot are interested in. And here's the gap of transmission to relay that those themes creatively, beautifully, winsomely, and compellingly. I found that Bergson, the appeal was that he provided that bridge across that gap. There was enough, he was so popular and there was enough buy-in and his ideas fit so well within Christianity. There's a debate, right, Jane, to your point, highly subjective, right? So where does that fit and how does that sort of track with, how do you map that with a Christian faith? I think that's a really interesting conversation. But I would also say there's a lot of subjectivism in Lewis's writings too. Like when he uses the analogy of prayer, when he's talking about trying to understand time, it's a very subjective kind of metaphor. But when you're trying to convey these themes and you've got this philosopher who's so well received and so influential and his ideas seem to fit so well within the Christian faith, I think he provided both sort of the engine and the track to get these theological themes across that gap. And I think they were all interested in time because of its metaphysical power. It was an interesting conversation, interesting topic because of Einstein. 20th century thinkers were obsessed with time. Writers are obsessed with time. But also, it's just that it is maybe the most important metaphysical topic, apart from just sort of theology proper, who God is. It might be one of the most, if not the most, important theological topic in terms of our intersection with transcendence. And I think that was the appeal of Bergson and Dari Petald in that.
Okay, so unpack that. I like your comparison at the beginning of our conversation, comparing it more with air, because yeah. You can have the scientific, well, you have most people, right? Almost everyone, which is air is just there, right? I breathe in, I breathe out. I don't think about this. In fact, I literally don't have to think about this in order to survive. Right. And then you get the scientific conversation about that. What is air? Which gives you a different perspective on air. Maybe makes you a little more aware of it. But again, you know, a certain kind of person cares about that from a fun fact kind of way. A certain person cares about it from a, I'm going to dig into this and go study it in the lab kind of way. Then you come along and you try to make a metaphysical thing out of air. What does air teach us about the nature of reality? So similarly, what does time teach us about the nature of reality that got these guys so excited?
Yeah, so Bergson's big contention was we track time. We understood and tried to track time the way a cartographer would a landscape. Right. You're sort of dealing with almost like map making or something, like you're dealing with it as if it's a spatial plane and you're trying to measure it and you're trying to understand its dimensions. And it becomes a kind of mathematical project, right? This understanding of time. Quantitatively, so for, you know, whatever time it is now, whatever time we started this podcast, you can pinpoint that, you can measure that, and you can compare it to whatever time it is now. And they really don't have any, that moment we started the podcast in this moment now really don't have anything to do with one another, except that they exist in a kind of successive relationship, right? A linear relationship. But that's not just, that's just not how it feels. So in that case, if you think of time that way and you think about your lifespan, or you think about the 20th century, the 21st century human history, it is just kind of this line or this wall that you sort of just chart moments by, right? Our anniversary was that date. The conference is coming up this day on the calendar, and we just sort of put pins in it, right? The problem is Bergson's big contention, and the most, you know, sort of oversimplified way to express it is that's just not how it feels. Time just doesn't feel that way. So when I recall a memory, have you guys seen Everything Everywhere All at Once?
Not yet.
Okay. We'll use that.
Sorry.
It's very much a theme, the experience of, well, how we experience time is very much a theme of that film, but or Chris Nolan movie or something like that, right? Where he's constantly playing with time. One of the things you sure. catch when time is manipulated like that is it's not so much when a moment occurs. It's more what the moment is experienced as or how it occurs internally, not how we chart it externally. So instead of a line or a wall or space against which or on which or by which we live and measure our moments in our lives, Bergson's whole thing is time. He didn't even like the word time. He didn't use the word time. He used duration. That was the term of choice because time is like time. Time is it's now 9:12 Central Standard Time, right? I don't have an emotional connection to that. It's outside of me, but that's not really how we live. Instead, duration has this, it connotes force and flow and coherence and fluidity. And that is how we experience time. So if I started to talk to you about my six-year-old with Down syndrome getting cancer when he was 2.5 to 3 years old, I could talk to you about dates on the calendar. I could talk to you about being, it was June 2018. I was at Wheaton speaking on C.S. Lewis. I got a call from his mom about a fever he was running and going to the doctor. I could speak about that chronologically. If you get me to talking about, though, and I could do it pretty stoically. If you get me to talking about, though, what it felt like to those hours between going to the doctor to diagnosis, or what it felt like, you know, to drive 10 hours home straight to St. Jude Children's Hospital, I'm going to start crying. And it's not just that it involves this person. It's that it involved in something happened to this person I care about in the past. It's that something happened to this person I care about in the past flowing through this present moment.
Yeah.
Right. And creating an effect in the present because of the attachment the present has to the past, the way, you know, a river's parts of a river are attached. So it's not something that I'm sort of measuring myself against. It's something that is animating me from within. That's the idea of time to Bergson.
Corey, have you read David Jones's The Anathemata?
Mm-mm.
David Jones is kind of the lost modernist poet. Yeats, Eliot, and Auden all said he was the greatest poet of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
It's all about time. It's about what you're talking about here. And it the setting is it's 7 seconds in the mind of a worshiper during the consecration in the old Latin rite of the Mass.
Oh, wow.
But it's a, I think it's like 145 pages long or something. And it's, it starts in prehistory and it goes through I mean, it goes through everything. It goes through Arthurian legends and through like the Phoenician shipyards and everything. And it's just about those strange resonances and coherences that happen within time. I don't know. You might want to check it out. And I'd be really interested in whether you think that.
I'd love to.
Because I'm almost wondering if Jones is attempting kind of a supra Bergsonian poetic vision of time here, because yeah, we should talk about it. Read it, and we should talk about it sometime.
I'd love to. Yeah, that sounds fascinating. And I read your Jane, your chapter, and you get into one of my favorite novels, Descent into Hell by Williams.
Oh, I'm glad you know that one. Good.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. And I agree.
It's superb, isn't it?
It's superb and it's terrifying. Yeah, it is one of the scariest books I've ever read, because I remember reading it in seminary and thinking, well, I could be going to hell. I mean, legitimately, like
I know,
like I am choosing myself in such a manner. You know, the trope in that book is the same that it sounds like that's in this poem by Jones. And it comes up again and again. Any film that when you start to sort of think about time this way, you can see creatively why people go to this trope of time so often. So like, why have a flashback in a film? Why do that, right? Why bring, if you're reading a novel, why bring in a moment that doesn't exist in the present at all? Well, it's only so that you can emotionally connect to what's happening in the present. We don't really care what's happening in the past. You know, if you're a Batman fan, you know, there's one scene from Batman's childhood, that you're going to have, that's going to be in the film. You're going to have to see his parents get shot, and you're going to have to see him first be exposed to bats. Those two things happen, right? Why do we care? You could just narrate that. You don't even have to really go there. You could just sort of assume it. There could be a sort of an allusion to it. Like, we don't have to have it depicted. Well, it's because of that moment and the memory of that moment's connection to fear, which is an intensity. Bergson calls emotions intensities, which is an intensity that animates the present, right? That becomes a lot of the motivation for why Batman does what he does, right? But we have to compact and sort of manipulate and creatively mash up these moments from the past to animate the present to give us that visceral experience. But it only really matters because Bergson's whole contention is that the past flows into the present. Past is real, but it's only real in that it only really matters in so much as what it does for the present. And the future doesn't exist at all. The future is sort of the present waiting to happen, right? But we are sort of living out this present dynamic moment all the time as the past flows into us. So if you read something like The Great Divorce, my favorite novel by Lewis. So the whole book is really interesting from a creative standpoint. I almost feel like if you were to pitch that book to a publisher today, they would reject it flat out. Like, you're going to write a book about a series of conversations. Like, that's the plot. The plot is you're going to give me 10 conversations in a really weird kind of paranormal place. Like, what? But see, for Lewis, I think influenced by Bergson, that is exactly what time does spiritually. The only, you see these solid people come from the mountains, right? And they approach the ghost and they're trying to get them to come to heaven, essentially, right? Come with me, choose something other than yourself and come with me. Every one of the ghosts that rejects, and they all reject except one, say the same thing, more or less. Not now. Right. I'll do it later. Or they refer to the past and something they're hung up on. But the one thing they can't do is attend to the present. And the solid people, the glorified people, say the same thing every time. No. There are no other moments. It's only now. Everything is now. Like, all of spiritual activity is happening right now. Lewis says elsewhere in the Screwtape Letters, right, from Screwtape to Wormwood. OK, the one thing you want people to do is not, like, you don't want them to think about heaven. Right. Don't get them thinking about eternity. If you can't stop them from thinking about eternity, the next best thing is what? To stop them from thinking about the present, because that's the only actual moment that exists for God. Eliot calls it the always present. Mm-hmm. It's the only moment that actually exists for God in which you can meet the eternal. That is so Bergsonian in terms of the only animated moment in which you can experience life or anything transcendent is the now, the now, the now, the now. I don't remember what the question was, Brian, but that was my
plan of it. I want to dig into that a little more anyway, in the last part of our conversation, because if you were to make a list of the kinds of existential angst that most bother people today, like in this year, so many of them have to do with time, whether it is the you know, looking at, you can do two things with the past that are opposite ends of the spectrum, but both negative. Mm-hmm. One is to make an idol out of it, right? And that's nostalgia. The other, of course, which is much more common, is to allow it to define you in a negative sense, right? Through bitterness, through pain, whether that's your own personal past, then I can't move past this thing that happened to me, mm-hmm. or whether that's a corporate past, right? Corporate wrongs that are animating me either as part of a movement or mm-hmm. as an individual. And then you can do the same thing with the future, right? You can turn an idol out of it, which is what the ideology that started in the late 19th, early 20th century of progressivism does, progress, right? The future by definition is better. Newer by definition is older, or is better than older. Or you can look at the future with fear. And I don't know what's going to happen. I know what it's going to bring. But when you look at the world the way that you are articulating, mm-hmm. when you take that perspective, that my only point of connection with eternity is the present, mm-hmm. that changes your perspective on both past and future. Mm-hmm. Because it changes how you view yourself, yep. and your relationship to eternity. I remember one of the first things, I'll shut up and let you jump into this, but I remember one of the first things that struck me about Eliot when I was reading him in my early 20s was the fact that he looks at the past. So think about a happy memory from your past, something that really meant a lot to you. You can look at that moment with that perspective, that good moment, right? From the perspective of nostalgia, idolatry. You can look at it from the perspective of the negative end of that, which is essentially it's gone, mm-hmm. right? The disappointment at best and the anger at worst that, you know, that whatever, my honeymoon, that glorious moment from my past that meant so much to me is gone. And if only I could recapture it and that kind of a thing. But Eliot looks at that moment and he goes, no, part of the glory of that moment is the memory of it precisely because of your relationship to eternity. And that was the first glimpse from any of these three writers that I had of that relationship between the present and eternity. You can do so much with that as far as not just the academic mm-hmm. exploration and the philosophical, theological nature of reality type stuff, but the how do I live in the next 5 minutes kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the hats I wear is that of a counselor. So after did my doctorate in literature, I had some really hard life experiences and entered into a kind of phase of recovery and received a lot of help in that period. And I was so helped by it that I went and got a degree in counseling. So I see clients, sort of part-time. It's interesting in counseling, and you sort of alluded to this already, but in counseling, if I had to say there's one major challenge through all which all other challenges are funneled, it's getting people, helping people to live in the present, right? Mm. To not be obsessive about what's going to happen to them in the future, anxiety. To not be so harsh on themselves because of what happened in the past, regret, which ends up being a kind of depression, and to animate what they've got now in this present moment. And there's this, my favorite line from Four Quartets is only through time is time conquered. Mm-hmm. Which is this, obviously it's like the thing, it's an incarnation, right? Because there's this double-edged sword, man, we could just spiral in this conversation because time is this gift. Like our temporality is this gift. Like I think about Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle. That, like there's this sense of my mortality and just raging against my mortality being a kind of gift. Nothing quite animates me. Like if you're a good parent or a good lover or a good friend, part of what makes you quote unquote good is an awareness, an ever awareness that this moment's probably never going to happen again. Like I better hug my kids. Right. That's a real thing. So there's this sort of enemy that is time taking away these moments, shortening our days. And it's only through an activation of the present, which is a tense in time, that that hold on time is broken, or hold by time is broken. Like, I can kind of break the oppression of temporality by the liberation of the present moment. I mean, it's this sort of beautiful paradox. So you can therapeutically even, and I think that theologically as well, you can have someone that's absolutely dominated by their past and their future, neither of which really exist, right? They're completely void of the present. So they're trapped by time, it would seem. And the only door that you can go through, the only form of liberation, is time. It's the present, as a way to unshackle themselves from past and future. So, and once that, like, there's so many applications to this, you know, and I find it played out in good literature. I find it played out in good drama. I find it played out in good film, good music. But I find it played out most in, did you guys see, I like to talk about this movie whenever I can. Did you guys see The Father with Anthony Hopkins?
No, I didn't. And I know.
Oh,
I
man, you're 0 for 2.
On the list.
Or
I know,
we're
0
for 2, rather.
He won an Oscar for it 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It was during COVID. So, gosh, you got to watch the movie. It's the end of, I don't want to give it away. I can't use that as an example. I'll say generally, there's a moment in which he's aging, his life's deteriorating. You know, he's going the way of all flesh, right? And the saddest moment in the film is when he utters something. I won't say what it is, but he utters something that is very childlike. It takes him, and therefore you, back to an earlier time in life. And there's this sense in which he's lost his mortality because the present is unavailable to him because of what's happening to him cerebrally, mentally. And therefore he's exiled in a fragmented memory, and the future's lost to him too. He's just sort of detached from the animation of time, if that makes sense. And I can sort of think about, like, so many other films that play with this idea of, or stories that play with this idea of, like, mental illness or spiritual malady or something like Alzheimer's, even, in which the person can't access what's going on now. They don't have the capacity to be present. And that being the real curse, like, that's the real enemy there. The real sadness, the grief, is coming through their inability to attach to what's going on with them relationally and spiritually in the present.
Corey, that raises a point that I wanted to raise in case some of our listeners run and buy some of these poems and try to read them, you know, try to read through The Wasteland or Ash Wednesday or The Four Quartets or The Age of Anxiety or The Anathemata, and they get into these things and they realize how densely packed they are with allusions to the past.
Yeah, yeah.
They're almost impossible to just navigate if you don't have really a pretty solid grounding in the classical liberal arts tradition. And so I think that's something that could be startling after this whole conversation about the importance of the presence and the influence on art and all that. And then if you went and you looked at some of these works, you might say, I don't even see how this is about the present. It feels like it's just a mass of details about the past.
Yeah.
I think especially of The Wasteland, but even portions of The Four Quartets. I mean, it's very elusive. Even the whole thing happens and there are moments of the past swirling into the present in the form of the dance, and you get confused and overwhelmed because we don't have a proper relationship to the past in The Four Quartets. That's
right.
That's the case in The Four Quartets. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why the past, in both a sweep form of, you know, understanding movements of history and epochs, but also in those little discrete details like we see peppering The Wasteland or The Anathemata, if you get to it, why is the past such a key part of this art that's responding to the present?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I want to comment first, though, on your point, because it was actually my experience, too, but these texts are difficult. They're just hard.
They're so hard. I'm teaching a course on the Wasteland this summer, so I'm going back into it and prepping for this class. I've read the Wasteland. I counted it up. I've read it for 16 years now. I am still trying to explore this text. So yeah, I want people to know if they go and they try to read these things, they're not dumb for being confused by these texts. I just really wanted that to be clear for all of our listeners. But yes, go ahead and keep going. Sorry.
No, even Four Quartets at times, there are moments where I'm like, this is so sophisticated and so complex. I think I have a grasp, but and then a lot of times, like, you know, like with The Wasteland, or you read James Joyce's Ulysses or something like that, and like, they don't want you to understand. I mean, that's part of the experience is they're defined.
There's a density, an intentional density there to the text. Yeah.
Yeah. One of my favorite sort of stories about James Joyce is apparently he had terrible eyesight, and he wrote a lot of his, like Finnegan's Wake and Ulysses, he would write them on butcher paper. He would like spread the paper out on the floor. And apparently he had this room that he would do his writing in. And the story goes that his wife would hear him laughing to himself as he was writing, because it was a prank on all of us, right? We're never going to.
That's so funny.
I know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like, don't be discouraged. I mean, the book of Revelation is in our Bible, right? I mean, we're meant to read it and study it, and like, good luck. Right. Good.
Yeah.
Understanding it. So we shouldn't be deterred by, it's okay to be discouraged, but we shouldn't be deterred by the impenetrability of these texts. I think part of the formation is the struggle of trying to read them, you know?
And I'm interested in why should our listeners go away motivated to learn more about the past and to ground themselves in the past if the present is what matters? How do we strike a balance there?
Yeah.
Does that question make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Corey?
But here's,
okay.
And I think the short answer is, well, there is no such thing as the present apart from the past. You can't, you know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I couldn't say, hey, do you understand the color white, if there weren't a black or a shade to contrast it? So because there is a successive durative element to time, because there is a flow, because there is a sequence, I don't have a present apart from the past. I cannot understand myself today unless I understand kind of what happened to me yesterday or what happened to me 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So in one sense, all that matters is, it's that great, you know, kind of a play on that great quote in Tolkien, right? All you have to do is, sort of make the best of the time given you. All that matters is now, but gosh, there's so much poured into the now that I've got to contend with.
And now only matters because of
it only
then.
Matters. It only matters.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when someone, you know, there's this sort of thing that happens in grief when someone dies, that we've all lost people. This is kind of a fascinating thing that I've started to think about. So they've passed away. We're grieving their absence in the now, right? We miss them now. We want them here now. But the only reason we care is because we've known them in the then, right? The emotional, relational power flow of those successive durative moments in the past has propped us up relationally in such a way that we really, really lament them not being in the now. Hmm. If someone passes and that I didn't have a past with, I don't really care about their present. I don't mean that in a callous way. I just don't. People die all the time. I don't shed tears over necessarily the death of a stranger the way certainly not the way I would the death of someone I've shared all these past memories with. So we can't help but be invested in the present because of the relational deposits made in the past. It's interesting theologically or biblically. Why does God constantly tell the Israelites to remember, right?
Yeah.
Always remember what I've done for you. Remember how I liberated you from the land of the oppressors and what I did in your father's day and your father's father's day. And the Israelites commit this sin of forgetfulness, where they forget the faithfulness of God. Well, why does that even matter? I mean, part of what God's doing there is, if you can access the power of the past, you can live in it in the present, right? And if you detach, those two things, then you lose the power of both. They both become meaningless in a sense. So I think good literature like four quartets, good literature like The Great Divorce or Screwtape Letters or your favorite novel. The saddest I've ever been reading a book, and I'm sure you guys, I've heard this, other people have this experience too. You're going to know what I'm going to say before I even say it. The saddest line of literature to me is one of them is, well, I'm back at the end of Lord of the Rings. Like, I'm so sad to read Sam, well, I'm to be back home, because I have shared, you know, a year's worth of a journey in this epic, building these moments that lead to that present, well, I'm back, that present declaration, that utterance that is so in, it's so just injected with grief and sadness and meaning and redemption and beauty and loss and gain and all these things. But that's the only reason we have that emotional connection to any character in any form of fiction. It's because we have been with them on the journey. The past has built up power and is living in the present as we interact with it.
There's a corporate dimension to this too, right? Tim Padgett at the Colson Center and I were talking about this earlier. Any story that's about somebody with amnesia, I think about Memento, the central question isn't who was I, it's who am I? The minute you're cut off from the memory of your past, you don't know who you are. And your first question is, who am I? And there's a corporate dimension to that too. Right. And a lot of the challenges that we have as Christians in our particular time can be traced on some level to our corporate amnesia, the sheer amount of our corporate, our shared past that we're cut off from, either because our denomination doesn't like large chunks of it and chooses to forget, or because we personally never got the education. Well, this is why the Anselm Society exists in a nutshell. It's because the Christian imagination is a thing. It can be formed. It affects past and future. It affects us for eternity. But if we try to develop one in the absence of 2,000 years of shared culture, shared memory, stories and songs and poetry and scripture and heroes and villains, that is a very tall order. And I think that's one of the reasons why this time question is so important on the individual level. You've made so many good points, both of you, about how we even put one foot in front of the other as functioning humans, without a healthy understanding of past, future, present, and eternity, and the relationships between those things. But there's this that corporate dimension to it too, not just who am I, but who am I as a part of a we, the body of Christ.
Yeah. That's really important.
Yeah, that's huge. There's a you ever wonder about, like, so there's a town in South Carolina, my last name's Latta, it's Scottish. There's a town in South Carolina called Latta, South Carolina. And apparently every year they have like an international family reunion. Latta's from all over the, and I want to go because I just think it'd be fun. But it's, those things are really interesting to me. It's kind of like, why? Mm. Like, why do I want to go, right? But there's this, I really believe, like I did the 23andMe thing, you know. I really, the more pieces I can get sort of my past in the right order, the more I can understand my present. Like it'll change. This was like a psychic shift for me. I found out in my family line, there are tons and tons of, so my first name's James, so James is a Latta family name. There are lots and lots of lawyers and ministers. And going all the way back to our days in Irishshire, Scotland, lawyers and ministers. Well, I like to argue and debate and things like that, but also I've been in ministry. Like, there's this sense of like, you know what? I understand myself better individually, because I've placed myself in this sort of corporate, this past communal family. I just think that's really fascinating. I love like liturgical literature for this same reason. It becomes about, I'm the one saying it here now, but in so doing, I'm joining into this historic universal thing that, you know, certainly precedes my present moment, but my moment has more meaning because there are moments that precede.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Well, we're out of time. I want to wrap up the conversation, even though I am beginning to think we should have just planned for a 3-part series or something. But thank you both for joining me for this conversation. Corey, if the listeners are walking away from this conversation with head ringing with all these different thoughts and where do I go next? Yeah, remind us again the name of your book and maybe one other recommendation for where listeners might go next for further learning or further reading.
Yeah, so this one is called When the Eternal Can Be Met, the Bergsonian Theology of Time and the Works of C.S. Lewis, T.S. Eliot, and W.H. Auden. I've got a couple others out. I'll mention just one, C.S. Lewis, The Art of Writing. I'm at work on one now on a kind of a theology of creativity that's been extremely hard to write. It's a small little book and it's been a big challenge. And then I've got a blog called The Thing Beneath that I'm just the worst about being faithful to. I like everything I write for it and I don't write enough. I've just got to get consistency down, but yeah. And you can get those books on Amazon or whiffandstock.com. That's the publisher's website.
Great. Well, thank you both for the conversation. And we will continue the conversation on our next Imagination Redeemed episodes. And also at our Imagination Redeemed conference this fall, September 30th, October 1st, the entire theme of which will be what to do with the time that is given to us, where we'll have an entire weekend to delve into these kinds of questions. Thank you, guys.